Captain Peter Hinton. Today's date is July 22nd, 1985. We're at Mr. Hinton's home here in Victoria, and my name is Mark Hill. Well, I guess first of all, I'll start with perhaps your a little bit about your civilian background. I guess to begin with, where and when you were born.
Oh, well, I was actually born in Shanghai, but I came to Victoria when I was very young, and just a baby, in fact. My father had retired here, mm-hmm. and from Shanghai, and grew up in Victoria. I went to Brentwood College, and was at Brentwood actually when the war broke out.
Oh, I see. Just stop this just for a second to make sure it's recording. Okay, now you mentioned you were at Brentwood College. I guess that's where you saw your first life at this life on sea, perhaps doing some rowing there or something. Or?
Well, I had been very fortunate as a boy. We had a Because my father was retired, we had a summer place out at Deep Cove, and we used to spend 3 months of the year there. And I think I owned my first small boat when I was about 11, and I did a lot of sailing. And yeah, certainly at Brentwood I rowed, and I was also in the sailing group there.
Now, you went to Brentwood through to grade 12.
And, grade 13, grade actually, 13, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, after Brentwood, did you go on to university?
No, I had been scheduled to go to Cambridge, and as my brother had gone, and of course the war was in process at this point, so I trotted down and applied to join the Navy, and was told to go away and wait, because the Navy was very, very small at that point, and there were far too many people trying to get into it. And I hung around the house until my father came home one day and said, "I have a job for you in the bank." Which appalled me because I didn't know anything about banks and still don't want to know very much about banks. So I went to work with the Bank of Commerce for a year, and then the Navy called me up in mid-1941.
Mm-hmm. Now, during your schooling, did you have any military cadet training?
No, absolutely none.
Was there any available?
No. And nobody was interested in those days.
Yeah. Was there any military tradition in your family?
None at all. No, my father was businessman in China, and I think my mother's father was a medical missionary in China, and no, there was no history at all.
So, obviously, living by the sea, your first choice would have been the Navy.
Oh, yes, it never occurred to me to join anything else, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, in 1939, when the war breaks out, you had what, just graduated from...
That's right, my senior matric, yeah.
And you immediately tried to get into the Navy, but...
Yeah, I had to wait. Yeah, they made me hang around for about a year and a half, actually. Yeah.
So you actually joined up in that...
41, in Vancouver. I was in Vancouver by this time with the bank. Not very happy memories of working in a bank, but I guess it was a good discipline. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we joined up in HMCS Discovery, which is in Stanley Park, still is, but it isn't the same building.
Yeah.
And a group of us joined up, 40 of us from Vancouver.
Now, what do you remember about your training, your initial training?
In Discovery?
Yeah.
Well, we used to go down two nights a week and on weekends, as I recall, and I remember it being a sort of an extension of boarding school in many ways, because I went to boarding school when I was 12, and I was fairly used to a rather disciplined approach to training.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't bother me too much. In fact, it was a lot of fun, mm-hmm. and a very nice bunch of people, of course.
What was your uniform?
It was a standard junior officer's acting sub-lieutenant's uniform at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the actual training process, I remember we wore gray flannel trousers and a white scarf,
mm-hmm.
no tie,
mm-hmm.
and a reefer jacket and a cap and boots and gaiters.
What did your training consist of?
Well, it was mainly... the old standby that all military organizations use is some sort of what they call parade training, which is really, I think, you know, they don't really give a damn if you can march properly. That's not the point. But it does teach you to respond to orders and to move about in a military fashion and you know, all those things that
mm-hmm.
all forces use when they get recruits.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you joined up, did you have any idea what you're getting yourself into?
Well, I think when you're that age, you have a sort of romantic view of it, and it's awfully hard to look back now, because I think we all thought that the war was a just war. It didn't occur to me that it wasn't, and I can well remember, for instance, when the Athenia was sunk quite early in the war, and I remember hearing the news, as, and it was in, I think, in September of the first year of the war, somewhere around there. And I remember, you know, we all thought, well, that's typical of the Germans to sink civilians, et cetera, et cetera. It was a totally different atmosphere, and it's very hard to put yourself back into that or to relate it to what somebody of my age now thinks about nuclear war, for instance, which I have changed my own views, obviously, considerably since those days, but it seemed to be the right thing to do, and of course you're immortal when you're 19 or 20. Yeah. You don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who worried about it.
And I haven't talked to anybody who's worried about it.
No, no.
It's interesting. It's hard to relate. Now, what were your conditions in the barracks and things like that?
Oh, well, I should perhaps take you on from Vancouver, because we were not actually on active service at that point. We were pursuing whatever our occupations were and coming down, as I say, a couple of nights a week on weekends. And then in late 1941, we were called up, so to speak. And 40 of us, I think it's the first and only time they ever took a whole group from one city like that. We went to Halifax and went to King's College, which had been set up as an officer's training establishment. And the conditions were great. I mean, there were we were living in the King's College, which was obviously set up for university students. It's part of Dalhousie University, although they wouldn't like to hear us say that. And it was self-contained, and in our rooms, or cabins, as we were taught to call them, there were four per cabin, and the food was good, and the regime was rigorous, and it was in winter in Halifax, and, you know, sort of the old business, you get up at 5:30 and go for a run, or try and avoid going for a run, and you work very hard, and you study very hard, and they're cramming an awful lot of things into you, and you didn't really have time to worry about what conditions were like. You know, it wasn't bad. The people were strict and stern, but in retrospect, they were kind. At the time, I think some of us thought we were being rather hard done by, but looking back, I fully understand why things happened. And I don't remember anybody sulking about it at all. We had a very distinguished group of people who we have two or three judges in Vancouver now, and lawyers and doctors, and people who've gone on to bigger and better things. And on the whole, they were really quite an outstanding bunch of young people who had been rather carefully chosen, I guess, and I don't want to sound as though I include myself necessarily in that group, but they were, I think, quite a superior group of people who were prepared to put up with whatever was needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that this was the only time that they sent sort of 40 people off from one distinct area. Do you have any pet theories as to why this was?
Yes, I think probably we were too much trouble. we developed a class spirit very quickly, and of course that's useful and desirable, but it got carried to an extreme almost where we, looking back, I think in retrospect, we perhaps excluded all other people from it and this sort of thing, and that really isn't the aim. And we knew each other too well, and the discipline was, I guess sometimes we got a little out of hand.
In, for example?
Oh, well, sort of skylarking that went on around the quarters and the university and weekends and so on. It was great fun. I mean, you know, that we'd had no experience with the horror of war, and you can intellectualize that and so on, but it doesn't mean anything until you've actually been in it. And it was just a big skylark for most of us, I think. I wasn't married. There were only two or three of us were married, and so that didn't matter. And it was just a big adventure.
So now this is on your sub-lieutenant's course, I think.
Acting sub-lieutenant, acting temporary probationary sub-lieutenants, I think we were, yes. The lowest, very much the lowest of the low, yes.
Now what type of training were they giving you, practical or theoretical?
Yeah, it was both. There were four major sort of subjects, as I recall. We did gunnery, which is obviously important, and anti-submarine. And a certain amount of what we now call logistics training, and what was called a torpedo course, which really was an electrical course. And then those were all theoretical things. And then, of course, there was the old parade ground business, and we went to do various practical parts in various ships. And it was all very exciting and a very good course. And the people were handpicked who taught us, and they were very expert at it.
Mm-hmm. Now, would this have been the only school of this type?
No, Royal Roads was running by then, for typical military reasons, we were sent to the opposite side of the country. Actually, I think it makes sense. Remove people from their own home environment, and then they don't worry about going home on weekends and stuff like that. It really is better, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad about that. What did you do during your off time, or how much off time would you get on a course like that?
Well, we used to work. I can't recall what time we got off on Saturdays. I think it was 4 o'clock or something like that. And we had Sundays pretty much free, except we had to go to a church parade in the morning. Mm-hmm. But we worked, sort of 5.5 days a week, I guess you might say. And there wasn't time in the evenings, nor, to the best of my memory, did we have leave to go outside the establishment in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
We did the thing that sort of thing that young men of that age do. I guess it's the sort of thing young university students do now.
Mm-hmm.
We chased around trying to find girls to take to dances on Saturday night. And Halifax, although it developed a rather bad reputation, and which culminated eventually in the riots,
mm-hmm.
with naval people, and I think with some justification on both sides, we're in a position, I guess, where we met very nice people. And I still have a lot of friends who I met during that period, actually, in Halifax.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've just touched a little bit on the civilian and military or naval relations in Halifax. Do you have any comments, any further comments on that while you were going through your course? How did the civilians feel about the naval presence?
Well, as I say, from the point of view that I had, which was a rather restricted one, because I wasn't a young sailor from Regina coming ashore from a corvette with, that I'm sure was extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But from my point of view, which was a privileged one in some senses,
mm-hmm.
It was fine. We met all sorts of nice people who took us into their homes, and we took their daughters out to dances and stuff like that. It was all pretty mild, but looking back, it was great fun, and I guess we learned to drink and stuff like, the sort of thing that a undergraduate does nowadays. It isn't that much different.
Yeah. Now, when you're out on the ships in training, for a start, do you remember any of the ships you were training on?
Oh, gosh, I can remember one. I think it was called the Chambly, was it? It was not a warship. It was a converted ship of some sort. I think maybe a fisheries vessel or something. And my main memory of it is being violently seasick. And the absolutely ghastly food. I can remember breakfast. These were inherited things from the Royal Navy. I incidentally think a lot of the traditions we inherited from the Royal Navy were great, but some of them were ghastly, including the food. And sort of standard breakfast was something called red leaden bacon, which was stewed tomatoes and undercooked bacon, and that's just the thing to hand a young seasick person at sea for his first time. So we all came back having lost weight. Well, you're frightened, really, more than anything. It's not a physical fear, it's perhaps so much as a fear of looking like an absolute idiot in front of what we consider to be hardened salts in these ships.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, looking back at it now, that seems silly. But at the time, it was very real. I mean, we're entering a totally unfamiliar professional environment,
mm-hmm.
being chucked in with not really very much training.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're, certainly my own, I can't speak for anybody else, but my own concern was not to look like an absolute idiot all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're only partially successful at that.
Mm-hmm.
But all through it, and I think it's still true in the Navy, there is a sort of sense of humor that runs with it. And the people, you don't realize it at the time, but the people who are doing the training are getting a big bang out of your idiocy, really. But it was fun, and going away in the whaler at sea and what we consider to be bad weather, I realize now it wasn't, or they wouldn't have put us in the whalers. But it was all quite frightening, but very exciting,
mm-hmm.
and lots of fun, because as I say, when you're that age, you can tackle anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how long was this training course?
4 months only. Very concentrated 4-month course, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And following that, you were graduated, and what became you then?
Well, we received our appointments, as they were called, to wherever we were going. We all hoped to go to destroyers and things like that. Unfortunately, most of us didn't. In fact, I don't think any of us went to destroyers. They're far too complicated for people like us. People went to corvettes mainly. I shouldn't say unfortunately, but to my chagrin at the time, got sent back to the West Coast, which was considered, well, it was a common phrase for the West Coast at the time, was Coward's Cove, actually, for obvious reasons, and grossly unfairly, of course, because the people here, most of them, I don't suppose, asked to come here. I was sent out here as an acting sub-lieutenant, and was posted to a shore job, which absolutely horrified me, in Vancouver. I should say that Pearl Harbor took place during our course of our training, and very shortly after I got here, I got involved with what they called a Port War signal station that was set up at Stevenson to, ostensibly it was to make sure that no Japanese ships got up the Fraser River, which in retrospect sounds kind of silly, but at that time, of course, Stevenson was almost totally Japanese community. Mm-hmm. I never got involved with the actual taking over of the enormous Japanese fishing fleet, which mm-hmm. was going on, for which I'm grateful, actually. I look back on that I understand why it happened mm-hmm. and everything, but, you know, really, I'm a little embarrassed at what mm-hmm. the Canadians did at that time. Perhaps not so much that they did it, but the way they did it mm-hmm. was pretty harsh. But once again, you have to try and put yourself back into the context of the times and how people felt. Mm-hmm. And the wild rumors that, you know, Japanese fisherman X, who lives down that little house, is really a commander in the Japanese Navy, and somebody found his uniform and all. I'm sure it was all absolute rubbish, but these rumors fly. Anyway, I spent about 3 or 4 months there, and actually had quite a good time, because we had a little 26-foot high-speed patrol craft, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Yeah, it was great fun buzzing up and down the Fraser River. Our main function seemed to be taking the lighthouse keeper out to the lightship, which was in existence then, but it was fun, and there were two officers and two signalmen, and we did our own cooking, and we did 48 hours on and 48 hours off, and it wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. However, fortunately, that didn't last very long, and I got sent over to Victoria, and after a few months got posted to a ship called the Kelowna, which was a Bangor minesweeper, and that was a very fortunate thing for me, because the captain of that ship was a chap named Wilf Davenport, who was a RCNR, Royal Canadian Naval Reserve, as opposed to a volunteer reserve. And I think probably the finest seaman I've ever served with before or since. And he died here of cancer a few years ago, but a very fine man, and I sort of regard him as my sea daddy, if I can use that expression. Mm-hmm. And he had the most marvelous ability to be able to delegate, even to very junior officers, some responsibility. And we patrolled up the West Coast, operating out of Prince Rupert mainly, and up around the Queen Charlotte Islands, and it was an experience which gave me the experience of pilotage and how to take what I considered to be a large ship. Of course, it wasn't. I think Bangor minesweepers are, I don't know, maybe 180 feet long. I can't remember exactly. But we didn't have radar or anything like that, and watching old Wilf standing on the, and he wasn't that old, actually, he was only about 32, but he seemed pretty ancient, standing on the wing of the bridge with his pipe blowing the whistle and counting the seconds as we went up through places like Granville Channel and snowstorms, it was really, it gave me a lot of skill and confidence that over the years I still have in my ability to do pilotage, and it stood me in good stead. So that was, and it was a very happy ship. We had a lovely time, and some funny things happened, which I don't suppose should be in a history like this.
No, possibly.
Well, they involve girls and things like that. But they're all, it's all perfectly harmless, but it's all sort of typical of the kind of things that went on at the time. And we had a lovely time, and looking back, it was harmless and fun, and everybody tried hard. But I was desperately trying to get into the war, and I sort of volunteered for a whole pile of things, and I eventually, including bomb disposal, and thank God I never got selected for that. I tried to get in the fleet air arm, but my eyesight wasn't good enough. But eventually, I got accepted for combined ops.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly touching back on the minesweeping aspect, Were you ever actually sweeping for mines?
No, we weren't. They were minesweepers, but I don't recall the sweep gear ever, well, being tested only once. So we were really patrolling. I can't remember whether this was before or after the Japanese did their famous shelling of the coast up here. But once again, going back into the context of the times, people thought that it was quite possible because of the shock of Pearl Harbor and the overestimation, I guess, on our part of the Japanese ability to strike at will anywhere in the world, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we never saw any Japanese, but we saw a lot of bad weather.
So following this term, you go to the combined ops.
Yeah. Would you like me to... that's a pause. Does that make that stop? Having been accepted into the combined ops, they had just established or were establishing a combined ops training center up in Comox at the Spit. And it was run by a very famous or infamous guy named Windeer, Ralph Windeer, Commander Windeer, who, amongst other things, was reputed to be a black belt judo champion and so on, and who'd got quite eccentric on the Atlantic. He'd been on the Atlantic since 1939 and was sent out here. He certainly set a hard tone up there. It was a very vigorous, about 30 of us went up, it was a very vigorous 6 weeks to 2 months, I can't remember just how long, and it certainly got us into shape awfully fast. They had a very fine, looking back, knowing more about it now, a very fine assault course. They had some big wooden landing barges that we practiced on, and we worked very hard, and it was excellent training. I distinguished myself by nearly drowning, as did two or three other people. We had gone in on this, one of these practice landings, fully equipped with helmet, rifle, kit pack, and all that stuff. And the coxswain stopped the craft a little before he should have, I guess, and the theory was that as soon as the ramp went down, you just charged off, which we did under 12 feet of water. And this is literally true. I can remember standing on the bottom, because I just went down like a stone, thinking, how the hell do I get up again? And I thought, drop your rifle, you idiot. So I dropped my rifle and sort of came to the top, got swept back under the ramp of the craft, and I thought I had drowned, and I came to being pumped out on the deck. Somebody had pulled me out. One guy made it to shore, and the rest were in varying degrees of being drowned. It was quite funny, actually, because it was a special occasion, and there were a whole lot of senior officers from God knows where, watching all this, and of course it was a complete disaster. It was really was quite funny looking back on it in retrospect. Anyway, after a couple of months of this, we were all in great shape, and we got all sent off to the UK and as a group. Some were posted to the what were called LCAs, which are landing craft assault. They were small craft. And the two Canadian ships that had been set up, the David and the Henry, were being, at that time, fitted up. And some of them were sent there into the LCAs. I was lucky enough to go to the, what they call the LCILs, the Landing Craft Infantry Large. There were three Canadian squadrons set up, three flotillas, rather, of 10 each. And I had been promoted to lieutenant en route, and by virtue of my extraordinary amount of sea time, I think it was 8 or 10 months, but I at least had a watchkeeping ticket. I was appointed as captain of one of these, as yet unseen and totally unfamiliar vessels. They were an interesting ship. When we first got to the UK, we were taking these craft over from the RN. They were coming up from the Mediterranean, being refitted. And I got sent up with two others to Troon in Scotland, where we did some training with the Royal Marine Commandos. I remember mainly because we were living in a golf house in Troon with no heating, and it was in the middle of winter. It was just dreadful as far as the weather was concerned, and I was petrified with fear by the Royal Marine Commandos, who played very rough games indeed. Anyway, it was good fun. Then I got sent down to Falmouth to take over LCIL 262. They were about 140 feet long, as I recall, and they had 8 General Motors diesels, 4 per shaft, variable pitch propellers. And they had a proper bow. They weren't sort of flat like the tank landing craft. And they had 2 narrow ramps that went down over either side of the bow by an auxiliary in the forepeak. And this allowed the infantrymen to disembark. If you've ever seen any pictures of the Normandy landings, you'll see our flotilla. Yes. They took some outstanding pictures, and we're in. I don't think I've ever seen a program on the Normandy invasion in this country, anyway, that didn't have our flotilla in it.
Yeah, I think I pictured them.
I'm sure you've seen them. Yeah. They drew about 2 feet forward where you landed. They were flat bottomed almost, and they had a overall draft aft, I guess, of about 5 feet. The screws were well protected by large skegs, and their top speed was about 19 knots. They cruised comfortably at 15. They slept and fed 200 troops in 4 troop spaces. The equipment was very basic. We had 4 Oerlikon guns, 12 rifles, and 2 revolvers was our total armament. We had no echo sounder. We had no radar, of course, no log, no direction finding gear. Navigation was strictly, as they used to say, the Mark I eyeball, and and a magnetic compass, plus a sextant if necessary, and it's just as well that we never had to use ours, because the only one we had was pinched by the dockyard mateys in Falmouth. So communication was by semaphore or flashing light, Aldous light, or flag hoist. We had no radios. And despite this lack of equipment, the little ships which were built in the UK, in the US, and had come across the Atlantic on their own bottoms, were really remarkably seaworthy and sturdy. They had a fantastic fuel capacity, and the tanks were used to change the trim to meet varying beach estimates of what the pitch was going to be on the beach.
Mm-hmm. If you could just stop and comment on the armament. Did you go into Normandy with 4 Oerlikons and 12 rifles?
Yeah.
There was never any thought of increasing that?
No, because the concept of how you land, not everybody can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
We went in, and we weren't expected to shoot at anything, really. I mean, I think these were there for morale purposes, mm-hmm. and possibly, as it happened, we, bang them off at airplanes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But supporting the landing craft were the destroyers and their bombardment and these enormously powerful tank landing craft that were fitted up with rocket launchers and 4-inch guns and various other types of support craft. The concept was everything was pretty well specialized. The general purpose ships really didn't come into it at that level. I mean, obviously cruisers and battleships and things like that, but at our level it was very specialized, and I'll touch on that a little bit more in a minute. The beaching procedure in these vessels was to drive straight in at about 12 knots, and you just banged it right up on the beach. You dropped a large kedge anchor from the stern about half a cable, 100 yards from your touchdown position. And if everything worked according to plan, and landing was were made on a flooding tide, the kedge would be used to winch the LCI off when you finally got off. Going back to Falmouth, the ship's company joined, and I was very intrigued to find out that out of a total of 21 people in the ship's company, only 5 or 6 of us had been to sea before, including myself, the coxswain, and the chief motor mechanic. Neither of the other two officers had been to sea, and most of the sailors hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Are these Canadian or British?
Yeah, Canadian, all Canadian. Yeah, it was very interesting. They were a great bunch of young people. Sure, none of us were very highly trained. As I say, with my 8 months sea time, I think I'd had more than anybody else. After a few weeks, the refit was completed, and I'm just going to go off into a little aside here, if I may. And a great day for trials arrived. This stands out as probably the most dismal day of my life, and you'll see why. We were plucked out of our berth by a tug and pointed in the right direction, and I had never done anything like this before. I'd just been a watchkeeper, a junior watchkeeper, and a minesweeper, for God's sake. Everything worked, and we shot around the harbor for a while without bumping into anything, and when we came back in, we were supposed to rendezvous with the tug to be shoehorned back into our berth, because the place was absolutely jammed, of course. The tug wasn't there, and full of confidence and enthusiasm that only my age and lack of experience could generate, I guess. I came back into this narrow U-shape between two long jetties, all set to do a 180-degree turn and to tuck in with bows out, which we all had to do. What I didn't know was that in any breeze, it was virtually impossible to turn through the wind with no way on. In other words, you couldn't stop and turn the ship with the screws. And we drifted very rapidly and inexorably down onto the rocks at the end of the U. It was much to the pleasure of the dockyard mateys who were sitting there in the sun eating their bag lunches. It was terribly humiliating. I looked around at all my sailors had gone below in sheer shame, I think. Anyway, the LCIs were built to take the ground, so perhaps it didn't do us any harm. And we were ignominiously towed off by the late arriving tug and tucked back into our berth. But it was a very humiliating, well, it taught me a lot of humility, which I needed at that time. Shortly thereafter, we formed up our flotilla in Southampton, which was to be our base as part of Force J. And several months of exercising followed, which was very interesting and great fun. And of course, the place was jammed with landing craft and so on.
These exercises would all be in
Southampton? In Southern England, yeah. The culmination was two very large exercises near Portland. And my memory is not all that great about these things because they tend to get blurred, you know, in retrospect. But my most vivid memory of the first one was seeing a group of very distinguished gentlemen, including Monty and Eisenhower and Churchill, watching from a position a short distance from where we beached. And to our great delight, Monty detached himself and marched purposely down the beach towards us. And I thought he was going to give us some inspiring message, but all he did was stop a few yards away, unbutton his fly, solemnly urinate, and button his fly up and return to the official party. And I've always had a nagging feeling that it may have been some sort of editorial comment. I don't know. The second exercise has sadder memories. Several soldiers, not from my landing craft, fortunately, but the weather was poor, and several soldiers from one of the, I think maybe two of the landing craft in our flotilla were drowned in the attempts to land it. It taught us a very sharp, bitter lesson about how to do it.
What were the mistakes?
I think primarily not getting the landing craft in fast, you know, coming in fast enough so that you rode up the beach far enough. Because as it was, as the sailors went, or the soldiers, the procedure was you hit the beach, you drop these ramps, which are, I guess, maybe 2'6" wide, something like that, long steel ramps. Two or three sailors would go down first on either ramp with long ropes and get ashore and hold these ropes up as some sort of guide to help the soldiers who were very heavily laden with all their accoutrements, as they always are. And they would land, and you'd land up to, hopefully, about your waist. And I think on this occasion they were a little deeper than that, and I wasn't actually on the spot, so I don't know exactly what happened, but my guess is that they probably didn't quite get in far enough, and there was quite a heavy sea running, and I think they just got knocked over and couldn't get up fast enough, because it's, well, you know, anybody who's swum and surf knows the problem, and if you're weighed down with mighty packs and rifles, and don't forget the soldiers were learning too about this, so it was all, it was very sad, but you take a different view to training. The authorities obviously have to. You have to accept the fact there's going to be a casualty rate, a fatality rate, and there always is in a major exercise and of that nature, because it is so vast. This is the other thing, it's the scale of the damn thing, that these things are going to happen. And really, I suppose it's miraculous that there weren't more of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, the during these last few months, it must have been obvious to everybody that the invasion was imminent, and I'm sure it was. The whole of the south of England was jammed with troops, and every port, small and large, was full of landing craft, troop ships, and other vessels of every conceivable shape and size, and I can remember the extraordinary appearance of the ships designed, or rather converted, to carry what was called Pluto, P-L-U-T-O, which was the pipeline under the ocean.
Yeah.
I never found out the diameter of the giant spools that held the pipelines, but they were sort of built into the ship, and it looked like a giant cotton reel. They towered over everything else around. And at the other end of the scale of these vessels that were designed, as we were talking about earlier, for very special purposes, were converted Thames barges to such exotic uses as floating kitchens and floating showers and things like that. The kitchen one always intrigued me. It had the appropriate title of LBK, Landing Barge Kitchen. And some of them had no motive power of their own, because they were just converted Thames barges.
Yeah.
And others had a totally inadequate engine, which couldn't cope with the very strong channel currents. Mm-hmm. And the combination of this inadequacy with the inexperienced enthusiasm of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve midshipmen in charge. I mean, we thought we were underexperienced. My God, they were. led to some pretty bizarre landfalls, including, I'm told on reliable authority, a couple of them ended up in the Channel Islands of the eventual invasion. They just totally lost their way. Some of these exotic vehicles were quite hazardous to the rest of us. There was, you know what the Mulberry Harbors were.
Yeah.
Well, they were made up of sections of giant sort of steel caissons, I guess you'd call them, pontoons. And some of them were quite big. They lashed them, you know, had them all welded together. And then they put a thing that looked like a giant outboard at the end. And these things, some of them went across on their own steam.
Mm-hmm.
And they were an absolute menace from a navigation point of view because, of course, they were totally impossible to handle with any degree of accuracy. So it was, you know, like being absolutely overawed by all these strange things, some of which we never did find out what the hell they were designed for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, despite the concentration of force and the number of people, the secret of the actual timing was, as you know, very well kept.
Mm-hmm.
And they used all sorts of ruses to do that. And when we finally loaded our troops, and who were North Nova Scotian Highlanders in my case, on the 2nd of June, we still believed it was for a full-scale exercise. And it wasn't until we were at sea. Now, the commanding officers were told late on the 2nd we were taken to a conference. We were sworn to secrecy. So we knew, but everybody else in our ships thought we were on a major exercise again.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until we were at sea that we were allowed to tell the troops that it was the real thing.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction that you remember?
I don't remember any specific reaction, funnily enough. I think people were relieved, you know, because the thing had been building up and building up and building up. I think people were relieved.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, our flotilla with over 2,000 soldiers embarked, sailed on June the 4th, and we got a few miles out into the Solent before the postponement got through. And the return was absolute chaos, of course, because
mm-hmm.
it got through in dribs and drabs. We had no radio, you see. It was just incredible. And coming back, it was just like a traffic block on a major freeway. There were some spectacular collisions. I actually saw a large tank landing craft collide bow to bow with what I think was a battleship. It may have been a cruiser. On its way out, the battleship was on its way out for the bombardment duties. And it's still vivid in my mind. A great shower of sparks went up, and the LCT was just cut like a cleaver.
Mm.
Everybody lost, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, some extraordinary things. Anyway, we came back alongside in Southampton. We're sealed into our ships, of course, at this point. Everything was sealed off.
Mm-hmm.
Until sailing again shortly afternoon on the 5th. We're just there overnight. One soldier was offloaded with a case of VD, as I recall. I guess he was put into some secret place. Anyway, it all started again. And by this time, although the weather had abated quite a bit, there was still a brisk southwesterly. And for the poor unfortunate soldiers in their crowded troop spaces, it was just ghastly. And it was, I'm sure, the biggest case of mass seasickness in history. I don't know the total numbers of warships transport and the weirdly assorted special craft of every kind, but from the whole south coast, hundreds and hundreds were arranging themselves in order, and the order designed to bring them into the required positions off the beaches at the required time and the proper mix. 10 great streams finally emerged. Overhead, of course, the sky was full of aircraft, first with the patrolling air cover, later with the bombers, and finally by the transports and towed troop-carrying gliders.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadian Naval Contingent in Operation Neptune was quite big, actually. There were several destroyers. You probably know more about this than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Several destroyers. There were 19 corvettes and frigates, 16 minesweepers, 2 LSIs, 30 LCIs, and a dozen or so MTBs. Most of the Canadian assault forces were, of course, destined for the beaches on the eastern end of the Bay de la Seine, in our case to a village called Bernier-sur-Mer, which is about midway between Le Havre and Cherbourg, and about 15 miles north of Caen. When we arrived at our holding position at 0900, we were held off until 11:30, and it looked pretty chaotic. And when we were ordered in and got closer, it was apparent that the planned clearance of beach obstacles had not been carried out. And these obstacles consisted mainly of large steel tripods, many of them with mines attached. And in addition, mines were sown indiscriminately on the beaches themselves. In my LCI, we managed, luckily, to make an unscathed run-in. We were one of the few to do so, narrowly avoiding a row of tripods, and the ramps went down, as was the drill, and four seamen were first ashore, taking heavy lines for the soldiers to hang on to as they came out the beach. The disembarkation went well with little opposition. However, the soldiers were very much hampered by the folding bikes that they carried in addition to their full kits. And the last to leave were, and it's quite a funny story actually, there were four, I've never ever understood this thing at all, but the last people to come aboard in Southampton were four RAF pigeon handlers carrying baskets of pigeons, homing pigeons. Mm-hmm. And really, this is quite extraordinary. Anyway, this happened. And these guys were different. They really were. And, of course, they were the last to. And they'd never done any practicing for this at all. They were nice enough fellows and everything, but they'd never done any practice for this. So they were the last to go, and they got down the ramp, and they first of all, I don't think they'd realized they were going to get their feet wet, and one of them sat down and started taking his shoes off, for God's sake, and these people had been landing and sort of up to hip deep. So the sailors very quickly disabused them of that notion, and so they walked into the water holding their baskets, and they were holding them because they were quite heavy, obviously, at arms, you know, arms down, just far enough down that all the pigeons were in the water. And they were so concerned about the novelty of this thing that they really didn't notice this. And I'm sure that had it not been for the sailors there, who, the sailors were hand-picked, they were all very big and very strong men to be able to help, you know, almost carry people ashore. And that's exactly what they did with these people. They sort of picked them up and marched them and their pigeons ashore. We never saw them again and never heard anything about it. I have no idea what happened. During all this is quite amazing, and I've seen this in the movies too. Bernier, there's a tower in the church, and there was a farmer's field right up from the beach. And there was a certain amount of opposition, but very little really. And in the middle of all this hoo-ha and bombardment and so on, there was a French farmer out there milking his cow. It was just incredible. Yeah. And just about, as we were about to unbeach, come off the beach, that is, I had suddenly realized that I'd forgotten to drop my kedge anchor in all the excitement. However, it didn't really matter, as it turned out, because another LCI, 276, had been unable to get his ramps working. They were operated by a diesel engine, and lifted them up and dropped them, and he couldn't get the diesel going. So he came alongside me to offload his troops over us, and in so doing, he pushed us over onto the beach obstacles, and mines blew out the ship's side on the port side of the engine room and after the engine room, and the tiller flats got blown out. Fortunately, we had no casualties. Our motor mechanics were on the other side of the engine room, fortunately, behind the diesels when it happened, so they came scurrying out, but of course it was all flooded and I was completely incapable of moving. The only guy who hurt himself through all this was, I happened to be looking aft when it happened, there was a big fellow named George, I don't remember his last name, who was our communications number, and he was standing there, you know, with his headphones on to be able to talk to the bridge. And when it hit, George went straight up into the air, and when he came down, he was running. Believe me, he was running. The only thing was he was still tethered by his headphones, and I never saw a guy go so hard on his ass as George did. He actually broke a leg, I think, doing it, but he was our only casualty. The new batch of troops from 276 was offloaded over our ramps. And I can remember Andy Webb, the CO, saying, "Let us go, let us go." And I was saying, "No bloody way, you're going to tow me off here." Mm. And so he, after much grinding and crunching, he managed to get us off the beach. And although the tide had started ebb, we assessed that the bulkheads forward of the engine room and between it and the tiller flats would hold with our damage control, and with our own portable pumps and a couple taken from the other LCI working hard, we started on the long trip back under tow to Portsmouth, and we arrived off Calshot, which is just outside Portsmouth Harbor, mm-hmm. in a sinking condition, just holding our own almost, and we were whipped into a dry dock, which really surprised me because I thought they'd ride the vessel off, but
yeah.
they didn't. They took us in and put a whole new engine room into it.
Sorry.
All new engines, a lot. Did it very quickly for... I didn't realize our own dockyards could work that fast, tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. Only one of the LCIs in our flotilla got to the beach without some sort of damage, and however, eight of the ten got off somehow during the day. The others were stuck for two more days on the beach, getting themselves fit to come off again. There's a chap here in town who remained nameless. He's a great guy, actually. He was older than the rest of us. He'd been a newspaperman, and he had one of these LCIs. And he was one of the ones that got stuck on the beach, and being an independent character, he'd been a newspaper man in China and this sort of stuff before the war. He wandered off up into the village. There they were, sitting on the mud flats, and so off he went. And he got himself up into the village in the local pub, and he liked to drink, this guy. And of course the locals were celebrating the occasion with a long-hoarded Calvados, which is a very potent booze. I don't know if you've ever, it's very nice, actually, very potent, though. Well, they wanted him to join in, of course, which he did with gusto. And returning to his LCI several hours later, and rather the worse for wear, he found that the first German prisoners had been brought back, and lack of any other place, had been stuck into the into his LCI, which was sitting on the mud flat. Mm-hmm. So he came aboard, and he found that there were three or four German officers in the wardroom, one of them quite seriously injured, and one of his troop bases was full of German soldiers. And of course, as we all know, they weren't the crack German troops. Most of them were conscripts from Poland or somewhere like that. And anyway, he decided in his alcoholic enthusiasm that he should demonstrate that the reason that the Allies were doing so well was their technical superiority. I don't know why he got this idea in his head. I suppose you can edit all this out if you want to. But we had something called self-heating soup. I see it's just come onto the market again, being advertised in England. What it looks like is a quite large pop can or beer can, and down the center is a some sort of chemical that when you pry the lid off, it activates and heats up and heats your soup up, or cocoa. It was soup and cocoa, I think. It wasn't bad, actually. I can still remember the flavor of it. We had cases and cases of stuff aboard for the troops. I don't know why, because we had perfectly good galley aboard, but anyway. The only thing you had to remember was to punch the hole in the can for obvious reasons. Otherwise, you had a sort of lethal soup bomb, which would explode. Anyway, John decided that he slipped his name out. Doesn't matter. He decided he would go down to demonstrate that one of the technical marvels.